If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Our guest today, a noted author. He has written biographies on the likes of superstar Billy Graham, Ric Flair, Classy Freddie Blassie, as well as covering the independent wrestling boom of the past decade, as well as wrestling during the COVID era. His latest book covers WrestleMania 3, which is what we are going to be discussing today with Bigger, Better, Badder. WrestleMania 3 and the year that changed everything. Keith Elliott Greenberg joining us here at Post Wrestling. Keith, congratulations on the book, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you about it.
Good. Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on again. Every time I write a book, you always invite me on, and you know, I have a lot of gratitude for that.
Well, tell me a little bit about just, I found it to be a really interesting process of the way you tackled this, because yes, it is in some ways this singular event from 1987, but it had such ramifications in the years leading up during the national expansion and across the board. Like, this really is this culmination of Vince McMahon's expansion and the impact on all the other territories. And the title says itself, the event that changed everything. So, I mean, it must have been a daunting task that you're really doing, like, the history of a lot of these territories and the ripple effect that Vince McMahon's expansion is having on these companies that leads to this seismic event.
Yeah. And, you know, as a storyteller, I always want to consider a lot of angles. Like, you know, if I'm more, you know, I also cover non-wrestling related stories, and I've done a lot of true crime. And sometimes I'll cover a true crime story, and 20 years later, I'll think, well, remember that little kid whose mother was the victim? Like, where's that kid today? Is that kid in law enforcement? Is that kid a victim's advocate? Is that kid a criminal? You know, so I feel that it was important to examine the people in the territories and what it felt like to be playing on the losing team when WWE was just expanding in ways that were unprecedented.
A lot of this circles back to the first WrestleMania in 1985. And I know we've spoken in the past, that was an event that you attended. And that day leaving the arena, was there this acknowledgement that the game has changed, or was this still something that was, we don't know what the effect of this show is going to be vis-a-vis the industry in the U.S.?
Sure. I mean, look, the first Starrcade had taken place 2 years before. You know, Starrcade, I don't know if we thought of it as an institution. It was something that was, you know, going to be done every year until people tired of it. I mean, I recently wrote an article for Inside the Ropes magazine about the super shows that preceded WrestleMania. And even you look at in world class, or, you know, in Texas, or the Dallas Promotions Parade of Champions, that had begun in 1961. But there were years when there wasn't a parade of champions. It wasn't an annual event. 84, you know, was that critical one where Kerry Von Erich won the title, and those continued for a couple of years until world-class flamed out. But I mean, I don't think anyone envisioned that we would now be getting ready for WrestleMania 41, that there would be a 41-year legacy. I quote my friend and mentor, Ed Ricchiuti, in the book, who was the editor of the WWF magazine. And, you know, when I met him at WrestleMania 1, he said, yeah, probably 2 more years. You know, 1 year to go up, 1 year to go down. You know, it's a fad. Nobody thought it was an institution. WrestleMania 3 established WrestleMania as an institution. And I make this point in the book, not just WrestleMania, but everything that surrounds WrestleMania. I mean, you know, I'm going out to WrestleMania next week in Las Vegas, and I'm going to be with people who are coming from Europe, and some of them don't even go to WrestleMania. They go to indie shows. They go to comedy shows. They go to documentary shows. I'm signing books at a puppet show at the Vegas Repertory Theater called Kayfabe, and I saw that their show in New York at one point, a puppet, a marionette, did a dive from the balcony onto somebody. So, you know, this is, you know, way beyond a couple of guys taking bumps in a ring. And WrestleMania 3 created the environment for that, where now it is an acceptable pilgrimage. You can say to your boss at work, I'm taking my vacation, I'm going to WrestleMania, and they don't go, what is wrong with you? Are you insane? You know that stuff is fake, right? That changed.
Just going back again to the first WrestleMania, being in New York, can you kind of convey what the media blitz was like in that final week in the lead up to the show, and just
the first Mania?
For the first WrestleMania, and the fact that it was staged in New York as well, being very critical to its success.
And that was why WWE organically already had the advantage. They were also the largest territory. They went from Bangor, Maine, all the way down to Washington, D.C. There was no large, I mean, well, you could argue that Vern Gagne had a larger territory because they flew everywhere. The American Wrestling Association, but it wasn't consistent all the way spread out. Like they flew to Denver, but I'm not so sure there were pockets between, say, Minneapolis and Denver that were solidly AWA. In the Northeast, which is quite congested, you had everyone from Bangor, Maine, to Washington, D.C. was under the WWF umbrella. So that was already the edge. You also had New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, really big cities. And Cowboy Bill Watts says that in the book. You know, he had the territory. His biggest city was probably New Orleans. They were also working with the Houston promotion. But there was nothing compared to what the McMahon family. And so it is a media center. And I knew that I was a freelance writer at the time. I started very young as a freelance writer. I was 19 years old. By the time WrestleMania 1 happened, I was 26 years old. And I was freelancing. And I knew that anybody, any major figure in the world was going to come through New York. So I could pitch a sports story because every sports team, you pass through New York. I could do a celebrity story, even though Hollywood was where the celebrities might have lived. They all came to New York for promotional reasons or to work on a project. You know, I could pitch a political story. Politicians came to New York to raise money. And so that was an advantage that Jim Crockett Jr. did not have in Charlotte or Atlanta. That Fritz von Erich did not have even in Dallas. You know, and by 1985, Mike LaBelle's Los Angeles promotion had gone under and Vince ran that. So he had New York and Los Angeles. Those were the two capitals of media attention. So yes, there was a ton of attention, and it wasn't attention just on, you know, the local news. It was national media. And so there was a buildup. And everybody in the city, and I would think in much of the country, was aware that something very big was happening. I mean, Mr. T and Hulk Hogan were the guest hosts on Saturday Night Live the night before WrestleMania. A lot of people were disgusted by that in the business. It's like, wait a second, they're supposed to be in this big match and they're hosting a comedy show? And those fans, Vince was willing to let them drift away because of all the new fans he was getting.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable, too, if you go back to watch that episode, and not just their appearances, but they got to, like, fully promote WrestleMania throughout, like, many mentions on the broadcast. Like, that's not an insignificant aspect to, like, that last-minute push for, you know, just showing up for the closed-circuit viewings the next day.
Yeah, I mean, 90 minutes on the NBC television network, and people don't understand how rare that was. Professional wrestling was not part of the mainstream. The NBC national network did not do stories about professional wrestling until Vince started the expansion. So, you know, if I remember, I used to save newspapers and magazine articles that would mention professional wrestling. And I'd look at them sometimes like, wow, Bruno Sammartino's name was mentioned in the National Enquirer, the National Star. You know, it was such a novelty because it was considered such fringe entertainment.
Did you feel that that was a bit of a handicap for some of the promoters, that inability to see the forest from the trees, and you see that reaction of a Saturday Night Live opportunity, for instance, and it's looking at that as some kind of negative instead of like the broader picture here, that was going to hurt some promoters if they had that mindset?
And they did have that mindset. You know, they were afraid of the media. Vincent James McMahon, Vince McMahon's father, was afraid of too much media attention. I mean, and it comes out in the book that, you know, Ed Helinski, who ended up working as the original editor of what became the WWF magazine and then headed merchandising, he was a newspaper reporter. He wanted to do a story on a WWF show in upstate New York. And he was told, this is, you know, before the WrestleMania era, we're not interested in getting mainstream attention, because mainstream attention would inevitably lead to the question, the big secret being revealed. Like, oh, they were just going through the motions. Oh, they're actors, not athletes. Now, that isn't true. They are athletes. They're great performers, and it's physical theater. But there was this fear that if the business was exposed, fans would leave in droves. And, you know, the truth of the matter is the business had been exposed at least since the 1930s when Jack Pfeffer went to the New York tabloids and gave away some of the business secrets. Roy Scheider, after he lost the San Francisco promotion to Vern Gagne, went to the press and, you know, said that, oh, this is staged. Nobody left. Nobody cared.
Now, we look at kind of WrestleMania 2 in the midst of this, and, you know, it was an experiment on their behalf, kind of building off of what we had seen with Starrcade as well, the multiple locations. And that's one that comes out. I mean, at that point in 1986, is it a thought of, you know, you just juxtapose 86 to 87 and it's two completely different beasts that you're looking at in terms of WrestleMania. Cause I can imagine in 86, maybe Ed Ricciuti is looking pretty spot on with his analysis.
Yes. I mean, and I can remember, you know, attending WrestleMania 2 in 86 at the Nassau Coliseum. And then I don't remember. I had a lot of freelance work back then, and I was taking a plane out to Los Angeles. There was like a 2:30 a.m. flight from, I don't remember. I remember I had to go out to L.A. But I remember, you know, seeing a lot of empty seats. Mm-hmm. And running into some of the people I knew at Pro Wrestling Illustrated, because, you know, I was friends with these guys and I read Pro Wrestling Illustrated. I wasn't, you know, so tribal that I wouldn't read a rival wrestling magazine. scene, and I like those guys. I mean, the first time Bill Apter gave me his phone number, I couldn't believe my good fortune, you know, that I had Bill Apter's phone number. That was a very, you know, pivotal moment in my life. And I remember talking to one of the guys from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and he said, look at this, the scalpers took a bath tonight because there were so many empty seats. And what that conveyed to me was that WrestleMania, you know, in a single arena might be able to draw, but if you're going to do it in three separate arenas, maybe there's not the audience for it to go to those live shows. But what Vince was trying to do was he was trying to establish New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. There's no other promotion. Forget about Vern Gagne. Forget about Jim Crockett. Forget about the Von Erichs. Forget about everything that came before. If you're talking about wrestling, it's us and nobody else. That's why he banned the rival magazines from coming to the arenas. It was his mag. It was Vince's way or no way. A little bit like, let's say, a world leader who only allows the friendly press to go to, you know, press events. Not that I can think of anyone.
No, comes to mind. Speaking as a Canadian, what sort of was the dynamic with the wrestling press at this point as we're leading into WrestleMania 3? Like, it's very much kind of an inclusive period where WWF, I mean, what was sort of the ways about that the magazines were going about getting their photos and getting access at this time?
Yeah, as you know, that's part of the book. And, you know, because, again, this isn't just about WrestleMania 3. It's about the other territories. It's about the fans who attended, their experience, and also it's about the wrestling landscape at the time. And wrestling magazines were a key part of promoting the product prior to all the media attention. So by and large, with the exception of the promotion, I believe, in Mobile and Pensacola, there was that promotion, the Gulf Coast Wrestling. They never wanted wrestling magazines there. As a result, people like myself didn't learn about stars like Cowboy Bob Kelly until years later when I read it in Dave Meltzer's newsletter. And Dave Meltzer is in the book because he was playing a role. He was playing the role of, for whatever criticism he receives, of an actual journalist, like analyzing what's really going on behind the scenes, which was unprecedented as well. But prior to Vince's expansion, George Napolitano, Bill Apter, you know, the newsstand wrestling magazines were welcome guests at the WWF shows. And, you know, it was hoped that everyone would work in collaboration and those photos would entice wrestling fans to go to the arenas. Vince McMahon was like, well, why don't I start my own magazine? Then I can completely control the narrative and I don't need anybody else. I have no say about what these guys will write. If these guys are speculating, maybe I'm going somewhere else with my storylines. And I was writing for the WWF magazine. And sometimes I would be told, I'm going to tell you this, Keith, but you can't tell anybody else. This is where we're going with this. It's a few months away. So this is why we're going to tease this, but we're not going to blatantly speculate that this person might be turning heel. But that's where it's ultimately going to go.
You have some really great insight into just the whole promotion of WrestleMania 3, from the fact that, you know, some modern fans may not even realize, like, this was basically a 6 to 7 week promotion of tickets going on sale.
It's unreal, right?
Like, when you think about today, that, you know, the significant percentage of tickets are sold before any match is announced, and it's months in advance that tickets go on sale. Like, this was still at a time where you had to have the right match, the right attraction, and it was a relatively condensed window of this whole promotion where, you know, closed circuits and blackouts are things that modern fans, that they wouldn't even comprehend this being part of the package.
Let me explain what the blackout is.
Yeah.
Because Vince McMahon mandated that every seat at the Pontiac Silverdome be filled, the pay-per-view and closed circuit broadcasts in the Michigan area were blacked out. That meant if you wanted to see WrestleMania 3, you had to physically be there. The closest theater that was showing WrestleMania 3 was in Lorain, Ohio, which is well over 100 miles away from where WrestleMania 3 took place. The other significant thing about WrestleMania 3 was that previously, big wrestling shows were marketed to the region where they took place. So if there was a show in Philadelphia, it was marketed, Philly, the suburbs, New Jersey, maybe part of Maryland. But it wasn't even marketed in New York City. WrestleMania 3 was marketed to the North America. So that meant, again, people were not getting on planes like they do now for WrestleMania by and large, but fans from Canada could drive down there, or fans from Ontario, at least, fans from Illinois could drive up, fans from other parts of Michigan or Ohio. They could all converge in this one spot. And when you think of it that way, it does not seem that outrageous that you had a presumed 93,000 fans, because it was marketed everywhere. So the 20,000 you would get in Chicago, maybe you get 5,000. The 15,000 you get in Milwaukee, maybe you get 3,000 of those. But they're coming. Toronto, which was a giant wrestling market, I can't even imagine how many thousands of people drove down from Ontario. So you had a stadium filled with people who did not necessarily live in the Detroit metro area. And that was also unheard of.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus tax, for a limited time and subject to change, max one offer per account.
If you work in quality control at a candy factory, you know strict safety regulations come with the job. It's why you partner with Grainger. Grainger helps you find the high quality and compliant products your business needs to inspect, detect, and help correct issues. And the sweetest part is, everyone gets a product that's as safe to eat as it is delicious. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
And I'm sure that if there had been any, reticence, certainly a feather in their cap was the previous summer. They staged the big event right here in Toronto at Exhibition Stadium. And it's, in excess of 60,000 people for Hogan Orndorff, which is just, it's a locally promoted, bought show here in Toronto. It's a house show. And
it's a house show, and we've seen it before. It's not a unique match. Hogan and Orndorff had gone around before.
And when you look at things, certainly they were able to put on, as they promoted it as this dream match, which you do go a lot of mythology attached to the promotion of the main event. But like, this is Hogan coming off like a red hot 86, where you mentioned the Orndorff program drawing well with Kamala and such. But I have to imagine that if it was not Andre in that spot, is there any other main event that could have been put in this venue? Because I think that's so paramount to this whole success.
Hogan and Andre. And, you know, it's similar to the storyline we're seeing now with John Cena as a villain. You know, I guess John Cena might have been booed by certain factions of fans for years, but he hasn't been a villain since 2004. He hasn't been a villain. And when he came in as the prototype, and then the early Cena used to do like heel, you know, rap verse.
The rap character,
But we haven't seen that side of John Cena in a very long time. So for a generation of youngish fans, they've grown up as children seeing Cena as a baby face and only a baby face. So John Cena as a heel, calling fans, you know, saying he's in an abusive relationship with the fans, that has people talking, including people who are not wrestling fans, because they know John Cena. They know, but look, I say this in the book. At one point, early on, WWE had to give its promotion credibility by bringing in outside celebrities. Now, The Rock, John Cena, Batista, those are celebrities who came up in the WWE system. They have their own celebrities that they've created. So yes, there's a lot of excitement over Cody Rhodes and John Cena, but it is nowhere near what it was for Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan. I meet people who don't know who Cody Rhodes is. You know, I know people, they know who John Cena is because he's a celebrity, but they don't know that he's a villain. Like, you know, when I meet people in the straight world, they're not following it. Everybody in the United States and Canada knew who Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant were. And they also knew the very simple storyline. They were friends and now they're enemies, and Andre's a bad guy. And that is what grabbed people by the throat and pulled them.
When we look at some of the figures that you were able to track down, you mentioned Ed Helsinki, and I thought as well, like some of the people interviewed here, Basil DeVito Jr. I mean, these are people that are, you know, incredibly influential figures that you very rarely hear from. And that was a personal part of the book that I found so fascinating, tracking down these kinds of individuals where you get a lot of, detail work that would have been lost if not for finding.
Yes. And Basil DeVito was a very key executive in the WWF machine. And he was in sports marketing. He was not a wrestling guy. He was not a wrestling fan. But he understood how the NFL and the NBA did business. And so I remember being surprised when I would see non-wrestling fans backstage. But Vince wanted professionals there. And Basil DeVito ran that office, ran his departments as a professional sports marketer. You know, like there were computers in the office. Things that, you know, Vince McMahon at the time said, most wrestling promotions have always been run out of a cigar box and still are. He was right. He wasn't running things like that. And, you know, I would see these suits backstage talking to each other. It's not like they shared anything with me. I wasn't a business guy. I was a wrestling fan who happened to have developed his writing skills enough to be part of this world. But I think I was still regarded as a wrestling fan, a wrestling person, because I remember someone making fun of me because I would reference, this wrestler's father wrestled in this territory. And they're like, who cares, Keith? You weirdo, you strange wrestling fan. Like, where in the sports entertainment business? You're a mark. And I am a mark. I'm still a mark. So I remember really trying to contact Basil. because Basil would never, you know, open up to me. Why would he? And I was shocked when Basil got back to me. He goes, sure, I'll talk about this. And so now I could ask what was going on the business end. And no defensiveness. He was happy to share. And he said of everything else he's done in his life, and he was, I believe, the commissioner of the original XFL.
Yes.
Said nothing compares to WrestleMania.
Well, I would think for a lot of, you know, people in that kind of position, like even at a time when, you know, it was still a very closely guarded industry, that now all these years later, like these are a lot of victory laps for some of these executives to look back. It's sure. Like this was one of their grandest achievements. And I think you get that openness. Now this is not a WWE book. You have written before for WWE, but tell me a bit about any of the changes that you've observed in the process just by reaching out to people or obtaining photos. Like, how is WWE to deal with when you're tackling a subject like this?
It's certainly more open than it has been in the recent past. In the Paul Levesque era, they are so much more open. I even had this talk the other day on the phone with Bill Apter. And if anyone doesn't know, he's the legendary wrestling photographer who's now close to 80 years old and has been around at least since the early 70s. And, you know, he remembers a time because he was working for, you know, the traditional wrestling magazines where he wasn't even invited to shows anymore. And he says now they just can't do enough for him. And they also respect his legacy as someone who contributed greatly to the business. And, you know, last year I was at WrestleMania 40. And were you there?
I was, yes. We saw each other.
And you remember we were in the press box. And there were, I think, 200 people in the press box, and it was pretty crowded in there.
Very packed.
And it was packed. This year, there were 1,000 media requests. 1,000.
1,000.
That's wow. Like 5 times more than there were last year, to the point where a lot of people can't get in, and it's no disrespect to them personally. You know, if ESPN wants to get in and The Guardian and the Daily Mail want to get in, and the Los Angeles Times, you're going to have to leave somebody out. And, you know, I don't think it's like the old days where there's disrespect to the wrestling media, even though some of them are worthy of it, as we know. I think it's that the demand is just so high right now.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that among, you know, several outlets that has been the situation this year. But I had no idea of like the volume of requests that they're receiving this year. Kind of dovetailing on that. Obviously, when you attach WrestleMania 3, and I could sense like you had to tackle the attendance for this show that has almost become a religious debate among those that will go to literally Basil DeVito saying he will go to his grave maintaining the 93-173 number.
Even though he wrote it before the show took place.
It is. And it's you pointed out so clearly in the book that it's like, there are always the titanized numbers that were so clearly for entertainment. But for this reason, this number, and maybe it's a part of fans' childhood, it's like this is like part of their DNA that this has to be the real number. And I think
people can recite it like they can recite a Bible verse.
Like there's no other attendance figure in pro wrestling that has this level of like recall and debate attached to it. And I think for a reporter like a Dave Meltzer, I think there's the frustration that he has seen internal data that listed it as, you know, 78,000.
78,000 sold. But again,
it's finding out the exact number.
Counted everybody in the building, including security guards. And according to Tom Buchanan, who was the photographer, there were people tailgating and Vince wanted every seat filled and they opened the doors and said, hey, all you tailgaters, get in there. Any empty seat, it's yours. So, you know, they worked really hard to fill the building. The question is, was that building even capable of holding 93,173 human beings? My guess is probably not. But at this point, you know, WWE has been telling this story for so long. I think even now they're laughing about it when they cite that number. You know, it's a little bit like Hulk Hogan, you know, telling the story that him and Andre went to the ring and they didn't know the finish. He'll repeat that. He will never say, all right, I'm working you a little bit. I think it's a little bit different. The people at WWE know that wasn't the number. But like when I was talking to Basil DeVito and he said, I'll go to my grave with that number. Basil was having fun. Basil, you know, was not believing this. Well, maybe he was. I don't know. I don't know what rests in the mind of Basil DeVito, but we were having a fun, freewheeling conversation. And he was obviously proud of that number.
Well, and kind of lost in this discussion is the fact that they legitimately like sold this out with several weeks to go. And the question becomes, if the building was big enough, what would the demand have been? Like, what was the top point for this show if they could have fit it?
I don't know. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people. And I was working recently on a non-wrestling project. And one of the people on the TV crew was camera person who grew up in Detroit, and he pointed out to me that there were only like two or three roads that led into Pontiac towards the Silverdome, because he said going to Lions games was a nightmare. And so, you know, you hear all these stories about traffic that are in the book, like Aretha Franklin is stuck in traffic. You know, she's supposed to sing America the Beautiful. You know, it was really hard to get there. I mean, people were in their cars and it was gridlocked.
One thing I'd be very curious, because you've been through this process so many times, like you've done individual biographies, but a story like this, that it must be like, obviously for someone like you to dedicate this amount of time to a project, it's fueled by curiosity, learning the facts, and you're speaking to these Ed Helinskis or Tom Buchanans. It must be really difficult that you could go down these rabbit holes of all these other stories that open up, but you're still trying to keep it to WrestleMania 3. I have to imagine, like, you're uncovering all these interesting nuggets that you can really take some detours on that are really fascinating.
You can, but look, I've been doing this. I think I wrote my first wrestling article in 1981. So it's not like I'm, you know, like my career is over and I'm not going to have a chance to tell some of these detour stories, you know, in another forum. So it's like everything else. I've heard some stories before. It gets processed back here. And, you know, that comes out at another time. But it's a joy to be interviewing these people, and also I am aware that nobody is on this earth forever. You know, I intend to be around a long time, but at some point I'll be gone. I don't think that'll be for a while, but when I'm gone, this book will still be around. And so if in 50 years, somebody wants to know about, you know, the history of WWE making that turning point, they will be able to find this book and they will be able to grasp that history.
When you are looking at the history of the story, was there that one figure or so that, you know, has since passed on that you really would have loved to have been able to pick their brain? Was there anyone?
Well, not someone who passed on. I mean, it would have been nice to have gotten Vince McMahon to sit down and talk about, you know, his worldview. Obviously, Andre the Giant has passed on. You know, there were certain people I couldn't get to. I got to a lot of people. I used, you know, old interviews I'd done over the years with people who have passed on. But, you know, I mean, Vince would have been good. I would have liked to have gotten Kevin Dunn, who was the TV executive who oversaw the production. He didn't get back to me.
Swegler, who was like a real great
Nelson
insight.
Swegler, who was the vice president of television production, who worked with Kevin Dunn's father. So, you know, and Nelson Swegler, you know, that's a lot of knowledge there. And Nelson Swegler, even though he works as hard as we do, Nelson Swegler's in his 80s. He's still an active TV executive. But, you know, those are stories when I anticipate we're going to still see a lot of Nelson Swegler. I'm not being morbid here. But, you know, once Nelson Swegler and Basil DeVito and Mike Weber and all those guys aren't here anymore, those stories go with them. When I wrote Freddie Blassie's book, I guess that came out in 2003, perhaps.
Yep. Yeah.
I interviewed Freddie Blassie. I interviewed John Tolis. I interviewed Killer Kowalski. I interviewed the Fabulous Moolah. I interviewed Arnold Skolin. All those guys are dead. And that means those stories are no longer being told from their perspective. But I got those stories and they live in that book. At one point, no matter how many people are gone, those stories are now enshrined because they are in a bound volume about the history of WrestleMania.
In all your years, did you ever have a chance to interview or speak with Zane Bresloff?
No. I'm sure I met him, but I did not understand what a significant figure he would turn out to be historically.
Yeah, he's a really interesting figure just in terms of, like, not just like with WWF, with WCW, but the early days of the UFC as well.
I mean, this is a guy who was basically a local, he was a promoter. Didn't he come from Denver?
Denver, yes.
And he was originally working for the AWA in Denver and then jumped ship to Vince McMahon. Clearly, whoever was giving Vince advice at the time knew how valuable Zane Bresloff would be. Because it's like, was Basil and Zane Bresloff, they were really, you know, spearheading the promotion of. And, you know, when you talk about the success of WrestleMania 3, sure, there's Andre and Hogan, naturally. There's Vince McMahon. But, you know, nobody thinks about Nelson Swegler and Zane Bresloff and Basil DeVito. But without those guys, we wouldn't be here now. And so, you know, I'm just so privileged that some of those people spoke to me.
No, I personally, like, I love hearing from these figures, and I'm sure on your bucket list, it's great if you have a Hulk Hogan, but you know what you're getting with a Hulk Hogan when it comes to this, and it's a great name to have, but I mean, you're not really getting the real story from Hulk Hogan.
I tried to get Hulk Hogan too, and then, you know, I was on an A&E documentary about, it might have been Andre and Hogan's, maybe the rivalry show, because they had me on their A&E documentaries, and I was on the show. Hulk Hogan was on the show. He's saying, you know, he all but said that it was a shoot between him and Andre. He didn't say that, but he said he didn't know the finish going in. And, you know, I'm like, well, that's what he would have told me. It's not like he would have said, and I've always gone along with Hulk Hogan. And, you know, I may see him WrestleMania week, and we'll be very warm to each other. But, you know, he's not going to say, Keith, because we know each other for so long, let me tell you the real story.
You've been very generous with your time here. We'll just wrap up here by looking at March 29th of 1987. It's right there in the title, the year it all changed. If you can go back, like, what was the general attitude after WrestleMania 3? Was it the idea that, okay, whatever was planted in 83, 84, 85, by 87, it's like we have a pretty good roadmap of how this industry is going at this point.
Yes. And everybody, I mean, it was exuberant. And interestingly, I watched the show. We didn't have cable TV in my part of Queens. So I actually drove up to the WWE office and watched the show there. And it was an early show.
At their headquarters?
At their headquarters.
Yeah, wow.
People who were not at the event and they like had a watch party. And I remember being told to kayfabe because there were women who like worked, you know, at the front desk, or maybe they worked in like, you know, mailing out merchandise. And I was told some of these people are believers, so kayfabe a little bit. And wow. So I did kayfabe. And then I remember driving back down to Queens because it was early and going out on Bell Boulevard to a bunch of bars, and people were just buzzing about watching WrestleMania 3 and, you know, getting into these conversations with people. I remember at one point, like, being out on the sidewalk and, like, showing someone how Hulk Hogan dropped the leg, like, jumping up and, like, dropping my leg on like a tree branch to demonstrate it because I was so wound up.
Wow, that's a fantastic story. Any like notable names that were back in headquarters that didn't get to go out to the show?
Nobody important. All the important names were out.
Well, this has been fantastic to chat about. I want to alert everybody that the book is out now through ECW Press, Bigger, Better, Badder, WrestleMania 3 and the Year It All Changed by Keith Elliott Greenberg. And do you want to alert anyone that are going to be in Vegas for WrestleMania, some of your appearances that you're going to be making?
Yes. My dear friends, Randy and Susie Tyson, have opened a bar, DDT. The name's deliberate. It was previously in Brooklyn. They've moved it to Vegas. It's a wrestling themed bar, although it's also known for its cocktails. And I am going to be signing books there on Thursday, April 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific time. And it's a great joint. You'll love hanging out there. It's a Thursday night. A lot of people will just be getting in. I'll be signing books. Like I said, Susie Tyson makes great cocktails. You'll enjoy the general vibe. When they had their bar in Brooklyn, there were people who came only for the cocktails and not about the wrestling. Although I remember once, someone coming in and she like said, "Hey, could you turn the wrestling down?" And Randy gone, "Ma'am, this is a wrestling bar. So no, you can't turn the wrestling." But so I will be there 6 to 8 p.m. Then Josh Rice, the puppeteer, who's doing that show Kayfabe, the puppet show at the Vegas Repertory Theater. I will then go from the book signing at DDT to the Vegas Repertory Theater. I will give a short chat. I'll deliver some words about the history of WrestleMania. We're also going to talk about the theme of kayfabe. And then I'll be signing some more books there. Then most likely I will invite everyone at the puppet show back to DDT and do some more hanging out. And there are other events in which I'll take part. Actually, when Busted Open Radio has its pre-WrestleMania party and broadcast, I'll be giving away some free books at that. So yeah, I'll be around, and there's other events that have yet to be announced.
How large would the club be of those that can say they attended WrestleMania 1 and WrestleMania 41?
I would say,
was Bill Apter at the first one?
He was not.
He was not,
because he was excluded.
You might be in some very exclusive company.
Yeah. I am not sure how many people will be. Obviously, there are people who have, because there are people I know who are longtime fans, but I don't know if there'll be a WrestleMania 41. Like a guy like Evan Ginsberg, I don't know if he'll be in Vegas. Bill Apter will certainly be a WrestleMania 41, and you'll be there, right?
I will not be, actually. I'm back here in Toronto. So, I will be home for this year's WrestleMania, but maybe New Orleans next year. I do hope to be out there and get to catch up with you in person, Keith.
Yeah, same here.
All right. Well, everyone, I think you'll learn a lot sitting down and reading this book, hearing from some people that have really never spoken openly about it. I think there might be a book on Ed Helsinki out there. I mean, a real fascinating figure.
He's a great dude. And you know what? I didn't know Ed Helsinki because I worked with Ed Ricciuti. It was Steve Taylor, the photographer, who said, "Hey, I got hired in 1983 with Ed Helsinki. I was working for as a photographer for the newspaper. He was a reporter. He's the one who got me in, and I didn't know anything about him. And now, like, he and I talk all the time."
Those are some of the best ones, like just the fountain of information that you uncover. So congratulations, Keith, on the book. Thank you so much for coming on to chat about it. And we wish you all the best with the continued promotion of the book.
And I appreciate you, again, putting me over, as they say.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max 1 offer per account.
If you work in quality control at a candy factory, you know strict safety regulations come with the job. It's why you partner with Grainger. Grainger helps you find the high quality and compliant products your business needs to inspect, detect, and help correct issues. And the sweetest part is, everyone gets a product that's as safe to eat as it is delicious. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.